Hey Elvis fans, it's that time of year again. WUSB helps to celebrate Radiothon with some very special programming devoted to the living, slightly thinner Elvis, Elvis Costello. Friday night, October 28th, there'll be 5.5 hours of Elvis classics, rarities, live recordings, and bootlegs. From the post-punk 70s, to the country 80s, to the easy listening 90s, to the blues rock and operas of the new millennium. We'll also have an exclusive interview with Sophie Kuhlberg, the producer of the brand new Elvis DVD compilation, The Right Spectacle. Join me, John O., Mr. Edison, and special guests for a celebration of the man, the myth, Mr. Elvis Costello, Friday, October 28th from 6 to 11:30 p.m., only on WUSB Stony Brook.
And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Tuesday evening as we plod along in the course of humanity and witness its various pitfalls and historical moments. Today has a couple of those historical moments. Today, the U.S. military death toll reached 2,000 in Iraq, and the celebrations are already underway all throughout the powers that be. My goodness, the things that are happening in Washington. I don't know if you've been paying attention either to the program before this one or to the news in general. And, you know, the real news, not the nonsense. But the Republican Party, the government, they're very worried right now because of this grand jury testimony that's taking place. Indictments might be handed down at the end of this week, and who knows what that could mean. But it just goes to show that a corrupt system will eventually shoot itself in the foot. I mean, you saw what happened with Nixon back in the 70s. The same thing is happening here. You know, there might be an unjust war going on, but that alone isn't enough. You know, it's very hard to pin those kinds of crimes on someone, but if the system itself is corrupt, if the way these people do everything is tainted, then they're going to slip up on something. Al Capone got caught on taxes, and the Bush administration will get caught in the underhanded, dirty way they deal with things, such as revealing the name of a CIA agent as punishment for her husband objecting to the war. And that story's been kicking around for a couple of years now, and it looks like something is going to come of it. So keep an eye on the news wires. You might see some rather interesting developments in the next few days. And by next week at this time, we may have a whole lot of interesting things to talk about. But today, a somber note, as the 2000th U.S. military death was achieved. Of course, this kind of thing was inevitable. And a less reported number, of course, is the number of people who have been injured, number of U.S. people who have been injured, more than 15,000. And the total number of coalition troops, we're 2,000 U.S., but the total number is 2,194. Sort of gives you an idea of how much of a U.S. effort this is. And, of course, the number that's never reported, the number of people on the other side who have been killed, wounded, or otherwise traumatized by this absurd, ridiculous war that continues to this day. War, invasion, whatever it is you want to call it. So that's something that I think we can't keep pushing to the back page. It just needs to be on the front page. On Capitol Hill, senators are paying tribute to the 2,000 members of the American military who died in Iraq. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist says the fallen troops gave their lives for freedom. I'd just love to get him in a room for even 5 minutes just to get a straight answer to that. Died for freedom. Whose freedom exactly? Certainly not theirs. Certainly not the Iraqi people. And certainly not ours. So there must be somebody else. In remarks on the Senate floor, Frist said his fellow members of Congress were deeply aware of the loss. He added that those troops did not die in vain. Hence the decision to have some more die outside of vain. Is that right? If you don't die in vain, you die outside of vain? I don't know. You're dying for somebody's vanity, I'm pretty sure of that. Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid, this is the opposition, the people who aren't in power, says the Senate sends its condolences to those affected by the deaths of the troops. He says a moment of silence on the Senate floor is one small way of honoring that loss. So you can see Democrats and Republicans are sharply divided on this whole Iraq thing. You know, I saw something today. This is kind of bizarre. They do the poll. They do the poll every couple of weeks. You know, how popular is President Bush? Do you have more faith in him now? Would a Democrat do a better job? Is the war a good idea? Well, of course, Bush's popularity is just plummeting. It's at an all-time low and threatens to go even lower. But oddly enough, over the past month, the number of people who say they believe the war is a good idea has gone up. It was down to about, 39%, and now it's up to 49%. So I don't know what people are looking at to reach their conclusions, but my God, what more do you need to convince you this is a bad idea? More U.S. deaths, more explosions, more evidence of lying and manipulation with regards to the starting of the war, to the election. Sure, let's just stay in there another 5 years, and maybe then those numbers will come back down. Okay, enough about Iraq, because it's angering me and depressing me, and we don't need that. Let's talk about Wilma. Wilma, yes, that's right, the hurricane that begins with a W. When's the last time that ever happened? I think it only happened once before. It's awesome. Well, it's here now. It sort of passed us by here in New York and gave us some 50-mile-an-hour winds and a lot of rain. But, you know, it was hundreds of miles off the coast of Montauk, so it wasn't really the hurricane. It was just, you know, the after effects or the side effects or something like that. But still, it was kind of cool. It's kind of cool because so many people have been affected by Wilma. This storm has gone everywhere. It started out on the Gulf of Mexico. Inconvenienced some tourists, some American tourists in Mexico. Visited Florida, then came all the way up the coast, and I think it's now heading towards Canada. So a lot of Florida is out of power right now. So if you're not listening to us and you're in Florida, we forgive you. And then we have something else, which is also rather unique. In fact, it's very unique. And that is Alpha. That's right. They ran out of letters, you see. So Wilma is the last letter. W is the last letter. Apparently they can't think of anybody beginning with X, Y, or Z that they can have name. I'm sure I could think of somebody whose name begins with an X, a Y, or a Z. Don't distract me, I'm thinking. Isn't that always the way? When you need to think of something, you just can't do it? Well, okay, why can't we have hurricane names that aren't American names? I'm sure there's some country someplace where everybody's name begins with X. Yeah, in China, for instance. X is a very popular letter. You can have Hurricane Shay Wee or something. I don't know. What's wrong with that? It's better than just skipping through certain letters. Or if you really have no imagination, just call it Hurricane X, Hurricane Y, Hurricane Z. Or name it after non-name things. Hurricane Zebra, you know? There's all kinds of things you can do. But instead, we're now starting the Greek alphabet. So we have Alpha, the Atlantic season's record-breaking 22nd named storm. That's right, it's never happened before. 22. That is as far as when we started to pay attention. And so far, it's killed 8 people, and 23 are missing in Haiti. And they don't even get a real name. Alpha passed over the two nations that share the Caribbean island of Hispaniola, and that's the Dominican Republic and Haiti. Heavy rains on ground already saturated from other recent storms, including Wilma, which was blamed for 12 deaths in Haiti. And Alpha, I believe now, is only a tropical depression. I don't think there's any word of Beta yet, but if we get another storm before November 30th, there'll be a Beta. Won't that be nice? Yeah, you know, in case you don't know, in case you're not aware, I really enjoy mayhem and chaos. Not big into, you know, death and destruction and that kind of thing. I just like it when the weather is interesting, you know? When it rains 8 days in a row. When the ground gets saturated and there's no more space for any more water to fall down on it. And so all the trees start falling and everybody runs around and doesn't know what to do. It's, you know, it's a pause from the mundane life that we all lead. And so by the same token, I'm very happy with the way the World Series is going, or the way the World Series has been set up. We have two teams. We have the Chicago White Sox, who have not won a World Series since before 1920. In fact, Chicago has two teams, and neither one of them has won since before 1920. I mean, that's really something. And then you have Houston on the other side, who was formed, I believe, in 1960, and they have never won a World Series. In fact, I don't think they've ever even been to a World Series. So I was very happy to see teams like the Los Angeles Angels, who had just been to the World Series a couple of years ago, the New York Yankees, who try to buy the pennant every year, even the Red Sox, who won last year. And I was very happy by that because they beat the curse last year. But I always like to see it happen in a way it's never happened before. You know, if Tunisia could win the World Cup, that would make me very, very happy. Because it's the last thing you expect, because it's unusual, because it's different. And that's what makes life interesting. So if the Chicago White Sox win, we should all rejoice because, hey, that's never happened in our lifetimes, probably. And Chicago will go crazy. And then, you know, 2 days later, everyone's going to forget about it and move on to something more dull and boring. All right, well, we have a special program tonight, and it's not going to be dull or boring because we're going to be reconnecting with some people that we talked to while I was journeying all around the world, in case you were missing during the summer. That's what I did. Started in New York and went all the way around the world by land and by sea. And some friends of mine journeyed with me for a good part of that little escapade. And what we're going to try to do now is call them on the phone, and hopefully this will work. I got the dial tone there? That's a pulsating dial tone. What that means is there's voicemail, and I don't know how to check it, and I don't intend to check it. Okay. And what that means is that I took too long and didn't dial in time. So now I'm going to start all over again. I won't explain what I'm doing as I do it. Except to say that I dialed 9 to get a steady dial tone, an outside line. And now I'm dialing a special 800 number that has been pre-programmed to route to a phone number overseas. That's to save the radio station the cost of dialing overseas. Not that it costs very much these days.
Being connected.
Okay, they told us our call is being connected. And let's see if that actually happens.
Hanukkah.
Is this the voice of Hanukkah?
Yes, it is.
Hi, Hanukkah. It's Emmanuel Goldstein here, WUSB Radio in Stony Brook, United States of America.
Hello there.
You remember me, right?
Excuse me?
You remember me, right?
Yeah, vaguely.
Okay, good. Yes, we spent quite a bit of time traveling on a very kind of small train. Well, it wasn't that small, but the space that we were in was pretty compact.
It was very cozy.
Yeah, it was quite cozy. That's a nice way of saying it. We started out in Moscow, and we traveled all the way down to Beijing before we split up. And we did a number of radio shows. In fact, we did one from the middle of Mongolia, where we were inside a tent.
And you were on a horse.
I was on a horse for part of that show, too. And we talked from Tiananmen Square. We had the police run after us in Red Square.
It was quite an experience.
It certainly was. It certainly was. I still have dreams about it every now and then. You went on to someplace even more interesting after I went to Shanghai and then on to Japan and across the Pacific Ocean. Where did you guys go after we left you in Beijing?
We took a plane to Pyongyang, the capital of North Korea.
And you could do that. You could just take a plane and go to Pyongyang.
Well, you have to arrange things in advance. You have to get a visa, like for China and Mongolia, and they want to know a lot of things about you, the normal stuff like your name, etc. But they also want to know your occupation because they want to make sure that you're not a journalist. So we had to send an employer statement in what company we were working and in what position. And we had a little problem there because we are both self-employed. So we are our own employer. And then a travel agency said, oh, well, that's okay. You can make a statement from employee. You go like, yeah, but we are our own employee too. And then, well, it turned out it was okay to send a statement from a customer. So that's what we did. And then we could go to North Korea.
You got a customer to say, dear North Korea, please believe Hanukkah and Sasha are not journalists and whatever else.
Nice customers.
Exactly. It's not something you ask. Yeah, you select, okay, who can I ask to write this letter of recommendation?
Uh-huh. Yes, and we brought them a souvenir.
Yeah, we brought souvenirs back. So.
Well, that's good. And you mailed me a postcard, too.
Oh, you got it.
I got it. And I've had every governmental agency following me ever since. But I really appreciate that.
We send a postcard to ourselves just to check how long it would take to get here. And the interesting thing is, I think we mailed it at the hotel on the 1st, but the date stamp on the postcard is, I think, the 6th. So it's been in limbo in North Korea for 6 days, and then it arrived in Holland in 4 days, I think.
Well, the same thing happened to me in Poland. I mailed somebody a postcard from Poland, and I think it was about a week before it actually got down to the post office. I don't know what they were doing to it at the hotel, but they finally postmarked it about 7 days later.
Maybe just the hotel just takes the mail to the post office like once a week or something.
Yeah, it's possible. They just take their sweet-ass time. But that's the way it is in many places around the world. So, okay, so tell us. Now, this is extremely exciting. You get on the plane in Beijing, right? And what's the plane like, first of all?
The plane was very interesting. It was an old Russian one, Ilyushin. And we got on, and you think, like, oh, there's a nice retro 70s decoration inside. And then you realize it's not retro. It's actually from the 70s. And as kind of an air conditioning, they had white steam coming out of the white mist coming out of the ceiling, and it was Korean opera music playing.
Oh, wow.
It started on a very surreal note.
Yeah, that's the steam inside the airplane and the opera music, boy.
They vaporize water, so to keep the humidity level okay.
Uh-huh.
But it looks kind of weird when you enter an airplane and there's all this white mist coming out of the ceiling.
Yeah.
Like, oh, okay, it's good. And then you see a stewardess standing underneath and say, oh, okay, it's probably okay.
Uh-huh. And what were the stewardesses like on that plane?
I think there was just two or three, very few, but they were dressed in traditional Korean dress. And, yeah, very friendly. I think they're flight record and safety things are a bit different than a lot of other airlines. You get some customs declaration form to fill in, and everybody's filling them in with their tray table down when the plane is taxiing and actually taking off.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, sort of nothing of the, stow your tray table, put your seat upright. It's like, oh, just sit down and we'll fly.
Do they give the little demonstration with the seatbelts and all that?
They gave the seatbelt demonstration, and that's the only demonstration they gave because we looked in the safety cards in the seat pockets. Like, there should be a life vest underneath your seat, but there was just, like, an empty shelf there.
Uh-huh.
I'm like, oh, okay. And the cart with the magazines they hand out was blocking the emergency exit, et cetera. But,
oh, wow.
But it was okay.
Yeah,
because
it was a good flight.
We got there.
Yeah.
And they served us an amount of food that was really incredible. We got a really big box of all kinds of cold dishes. And then we were marveling at that. And then on top of that, we got another box with warm food that would have been enough for the whole flight alone. It was only 19 minutes. And, well, you could eat until you were totally stuffed. It was amazing.
What, was the plane full?
Yes.
Almost, yeah.
It was very full. And Sasha was cramped in between seats.
Yeah, it was
seats.
Very cramped. I think there was a lot of Chinese tourists on the plane.
Mm-hmm.
There was some North Korean Korean sports team coming back from, I think, the University Olympic Challenge or something like that.
Were they coming back victorious?
I don't know. They bought a lot of stuff to take along, like DVD players and other kind of things like that. So.
Uh-huh.
They looked happy.
Yeah, they looked happy. So, yeah.
You see, that's the kind of thing that, an American report about North Korea, there's no way anybody could seem happy to return to North Korea. It's a land of hell. But you're saying it was different, that there were people actually smiling on their way back to Pyongyang.
Oh, yeah.
In general, any place is different than what people tell you about it. So,
mm-hmm.
And especially, I think, yeah, talking about what kind of regime they have, of course it's probably less free than we have here, and there are some very dubious aspects about it. But it's still life to people who live there and
mm-hmm.
get married and get kids and get divorced and whatever. And
yes.
The same everywhere across the world. So.
Sometimes in the press there's this picture painted of, like, the whole country's evil. But, you know, everywhere you go, it's just people living there. And people living normal lives, and there's nice people and less nice people, and they have a sense of humor, and they make jokes, and they go out, and they dance, and they laugh, etc. So it's just people, and it's always cool to meet people from different countries.
Now, did you actually witness dancing and laughing?
Yes, as a matter of fact, we did. I think it was the second day we were there. It was August 28th, I think. It was the day of the youth.
Oh, wait, August 28th, that's when you saw the dancing or the laughing, or both?
Both of it.
This is a real shock to me. I've never heard of such things in North Korea. Okay, so continue to tell us about it.
The youth, and in the evening, young people gathered on a big square, actually on several places in the city, and we went to one of those places, and they were playing music, and they were dancing. And we were watching it, and then we were sitting there with our guide watching the people dancing, and he said, well, you can join in if you like. And we go, like, yeah, well, we're just tourists. Let's not be...
Well, we're Dutch. We don't laugh and
we're
sing.
We're sitting there, and then suddenly there comes a Korean guy comes up to me and asks me to dance. I go, like, oh, my God, because I do not have the best sense of rhythm, you know.
Uh-huh.
But he...
to
so
have that revealed in North Korea.
I danced three Korean dances with him,
wow.
But I had great difficulties because at one point of the dance, it involved walking in the opposite direction of your dancing partner. And it took me a while to figure that out. So we were dancing in a big group of people, and I was going in the wrong direction all the time. And, well, that's when people started laughing.
Uh-huh. So that's what basically was the source of all the joy in North Korea, was watching you dance.
Oh, yes. I was a source of joy, absolutely.
That's great. What was the predominant language while you were there?
Korean.
But, I mean, they didn't speak to you in Korean.
No.
Well, the guys you get assigned and at Museo all speak English. And
mm-hmm.
Some are pretty good and some are kind of difficult to understand. And it's kind of weird, of course, that they they all learn English, but they don't have any native speakers to learn it from.
Uh-huh. And do they ask you any questions about it, learning English?
No, not really. Their English is pretty good, but the intonation and the accent, you have to get used to that a little bit.
Uh-huh. Okay, so now you arrive in Pyongyang. What's that like when the plane actually touches down?
Well, you arrive in the air, on the airport, and there's a little terminal building. It has two portraits, one of Kim Il-sung and one of Kim Jong-il. You get in there, and it's pretty normal, like any other airport. And then before you get out, they want to check your luggage because there are certain items that are not allowed into the country, like GSM phones and laptops and stuff like that.
Okay.
And if you have a GSM phone, they will just take it, seal it, you'll get a receipt, and at the end of the trip, you'll get it back. And then when you enter the, when you get out of the airport, your guides are waiting for you because there's no, just walking around on your own. Every group who gets there gets two guides and a driver, and we were a group of two people. So actually, we were outnumbered by Koreans all week.
Wow.
And, three guys and then us two.
Uh-huh.
So we're a cozy little bunch with the five of us.
So you two are the only ones in the group?
Yes.
And how many guys did you have?
Two guides and a driver.
One tour guide, one quote-unquote government minder type person, and a driver.
Now, what did the government minder person do?
Well, he's actually also a tour guide, but it, after a while it gets kind of obvious that there's a different thing between them.
Uh-huh.
Well, he was arranging things like paperwork and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
And the other guide was the person giving you the facts and the dates and stuff like that.
I see. Now, what was their mood throughout when you were hanging out with them?
Sorry, the mood?
Yeah, their mood. Were they kind of like restrictive? Were they friendly?
Oh.
They were very friendly overall. And it's, I think the first 2 days was, we were there for 6-7 days. The first day and a half was kind of strange from both sides. Is that for us it's like outside of North Korea, there's this like entirely menacing, oh, it's such an evil country, etc. And of course, when you go there as a tourist, you know that you'll get shown all the rosy parts of the country and how nice it is, etc. But still, it's you kind of have this idea, okay, what are my guides going to be like? And for them, it's also, what are my tourists going to be like? Aren't they journalists or otherwise going to cause me trouble, etc.? And at first, it was kind of interesting. And after a while, you
get along. You get used to each other, and boy, it was very nice.
It's also because you are kind of restricted in who you see and who you talk to. So you go to the hotel bar and have a beer with them, and we play billiards with them, and you tell jokes, and in general, you got along pretty well.
So did you learn anything interesting about these people?
Not a lot, actually. No, it was more on the friendly, joking level and a lot of facts about the country.
Uh-huh. Did the subject of my country come up at all?
It came up when we went to the War Museum, or the Victorious Fatherland Liberation War Museum, I think it's called.
Uh-huh.
And because you are being called American imperialist.
My goodness.
I'm not surprised you.
And, well, we get called that here anyway, so.
And, of course, it came up when we went to the demilitarized zone at the South Korean border.
Now, that must have been weird.
Yes, it's actually a tourist attraction,
mm-hmm.
as well in North Korea as in South Korea.
Well, can you see the tourists on the South Korean side?
Yes, you can.
You can? Yeah. How close do you get?
50 yards, maybe, something like that.
And is there any waving or shouting?
No. I think from this, when you go to the border from the south, you're told not to wave and shout.
Uh-huh.
And we weren't told anything. We were just being shown around, and it's actually rather weird because when you're from the west, you get this picture of like North Korea, they're the bad guys, and then you go to the border. And all the soldiers there are all very, kind of relaxed. They're just standing on guard and not doing anything. Well, they're pretty neutral, you know.
Uh-huh.
And then at the other side of the border itself is actually like a concrete line of like 4 inches wide and 4 inches high. And there's this zone of 2 kilometers in the south and 2 kilometers in the north that's around it. But the border itself is really, well, tiny. And soldiers are standing on both sides, and they could, like, shake hands over the border if they wanted to. But I don't think they do that a lot.
Wow, they could actually touch each other.
Yes, they could, yeah, easily. And on the North Korean side, they're just standing there, being pretty neutral. And on the South Korean side, they were having quite an, aggressive stance, like legs pretty far apart and leaning a bit forward and clenched fists.
What, the whole time they were standing there, they had their fists clenched?
Yes, yes. The soldiers who were standing on guard had their fists clenched.
These are the South Korean soldiers?
Yes,
yes.
Well, what are they looking to do, start a fist fight?
No, that was just a way of standing on guard. And some of them were walking around, and they were watching us intensely. At one point, one of the guys just got a big, real big pair of binoculars and started staring us right in the face from a distance of about 10 meters. That was quite weird. And we figured it was probably like a digital one with a built-in camera or something.
Yeah.
There was no other reason for looking at us in that way.
Do you think you could have done something to provoke him and start a real incident?
Yeah, we didn't really feel like that.
I mean, just to make him come charging over the line, you know, to run after you, that would be enough right there.
Well, I think our host would not have appreciated that our guys in North Korea.
Yeah, but
they
would have been in the right, though. It would have been South Korea.
And also some North Korean soldiers standing in between us and the actual borderline.
Uh-huh. Wow.
It would not have been a smart idea.
Probably not, but it would have been interesting to see what happens.
But there's a series of little buildings that are standing on the border, and half of the buildings are in North Korea, and the other half is in South Korea. And we could enter one of those buildings. It was used for negotiations between the two parties, and this is like the only building that, and inside of it, you can walk to South Korea. So we have added another country to our journey. We've also been in South Korea.
Wow. So now, if you were in the South Korean half of that room,
yes,
could you stay there and not go back to North Korea? And would they? What would happen to you?
No.
When you are in that building, when you come in from the North Korean side,
mm-hmm.
there's North Korean soldiers guarding the exit towards South Korea. And the other way around, when people come in from South Korea, then there's South Korean soldiers guarding the exit to the North Korean side.
Uh-huh. But, I mean, can they legally bring you back into the other half of the room?
I think when it's in use, it's probably, okay, it's in use by the North Koreans, so it's North Korea temporarily.
I see. How did they divide up the time between North Korea and South Korea in that room?
I don't know. They probably call each other or something. And they can even yell it out over the border itself because it's so close by. But
they could just wave to indicate now it's our turn. I don't know. Or maybe have a time schedule.
It's a very strange place because there's like 7 of these small buildings. And on the North Korean side of the border, there's this very monumental kind of communist-looking building. And on the other side, on the South Korean side, there's a pretty new building, which is just a bit bigger. And it's like a metal structure on the outside called the Freedom House, of course. And both buildings have a lot of video cameras pointed at the other side. And it's
mm-hmm.
very weird because it's a very... Yeah, you can go there, and it's the personification of the conflict. But it's so strange to be there, and it almost feels silly that it's less than 100 yards away of each other, and there's people staring at each other with the camera all the time, and they come within 5 yards distance of each other.
And they share a room. I understand why they don't just have 2 rooms, you know, one for the north, one for the south. It's kind of bizarre. You have the most fortified border in the world, and yet they don't have 2 rooms. They share one.
No, but the room they have, there's like a conference table in the middle with microphones on it, and the microphones are exactly on the border, so you can sit at a table and both parties can be in their own country. That's basically the idea of the conference.
Who made the microphones?
I think it's an American.
Aha!
Uh-huh. Sure,
Advantage US.
Or some Asian company. It was not North Korean, I think.
Uh-huh.
One thing that was funny when we were inside that little building, we could sit at that conference table, and a South Korean soldier who was standing outside on the South Korean part of the building wanted to look in, and he really pressed his face against the glass to look in and have a look at us. And I think it was meant to be intimidating or something, but at that moment it was just so, well, hilarious. I just couldn't help laughing. It was so weird. You know, it was so contrary to our expectations. You think, like, oh, the North Koreans, they're the communists, and we're always told that they're the bad guys. And then you go to the border, and then the South Koreans are behaving like they are the bad guys. And they're behaving in an intimidating and menacing way, and that's just so not what you expect.
And the North Korean soldiers are more laid back?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, they were behaving very neutrally.
Well, I think it's also different that when we were there as North Korean tourists, and we... Well, for us, it's kind of unclear how the South Korean soldiers behave when there's South Korean tourists there or American tourists from the South Korean side, etc. But the stories I've read online, there's some people that have stuff on their website who've been to both sides of the border, say that the North Korean side is actually pretty relaxed, and on the South Korean side, it's under United Nations Joint Security Command or something.
Uh-huh.
There's papers to sign, you have to wear appropriate dress, and you have to sign that you're not going to make eye contact with North Korean soldiers, etc., etc. And in a way, that's understandable, but it's very, yeah, it's just strange if on the other side you can just walk up there and North Korean soldiers don't wear helmets at the DMZ, the South Koreans do, etc. They all wear like the
big sunglasses,
the mirror Ray-Ban aviator kind of sunglasses, and it's very strange.
Now, were you allowed to take pictures at that place?
Yeah,
yes.
No problem.
So you have any pictures of those crazy South Korean guys?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I got to see those.
Yeah, I'll email you there. No, it's I think the only place in North Korea where you're allowed to take pictures of North Korean soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
It's outside of the DMZ. They don't want you to because it's strategic, etc. And I guess at the DMZ they don't mind because there are dozens of cameras from the South Korean side on it anyway, so...
Uh-huh.
Couple of pictures won't mind. But.
Now, this October, this month actually, for the first time in quite a while, all of a sudden, much to my immense disappointment, Americans were suddenly allowed into North Korea. And I say disappointment not because I think that's bad. I think that's great. It's just I wanted to do that. And had I known they were going to open up the doors to Americans in October, I would have stayed over in Asia until that happened and been part of that. So normally, and I think probably now, Americans just aren't allowed in that country at all, right?
I think they were only allowed for, I think, 1 or 2 weeks, and I think the last time they were allowed in is in 2002, and that basically that right now, or I think it's almost over now, they had mass games, and they have those once every couple of years when there's a big political anniversary or an anniversary of the foundation of the country, etc.
Uh-huh.
And then when they put that show on, they allow both journalists and Americans in, which are normally the off-limits people.
Now, okay, these mass games. Tell us about these mass games, because I've been hearing a lot about them.
Well, the mass games are absolutely amazing. They are very impressive. We get to this real big stadium, and it's like a dance and gymnastics performance in beautiful costumes, and over 100,000 people take part in it. And on the floor of the stadium, there are all these people dancing, and at the chairs at the other side, where normally audience could sit during other sports events and stuff, there are school children sitting who each have a big book with colored pages, and at the right time, they flip their book to the right page of the right color, and so they form like a real big moving background picture. It's like every school kid with every book is one pixel.
Now, these people are in the stands, right?
Yep.
When they do that, and they're flipping a page of a book. I always thought it was full size, like it was taking up, there doesn't seem to be any gap. A picture of a book doesn't seem like it would be big enough to create that effect.
But it's not a book-sized book. It's
a big book.
It's pretty huge. But they have, I think I bought one booklet in North Korea explaining how they do the backgrounds and how they used to have those backgrounds with like 20 different colors.
Uh-huh.
And that's it. And now they have books of about 200 pages with all the different, because they have kind of higher resolution if there's, if it's not one equal color on each page. But it's really amazing to see how they all do it synchronized. And I think the entire display is about 10,000 people.
Uh-huh.
And, numbers like that, it's, if you go to a rock concert, the audience is 10,000 people.
Right.
Yeah, what's part of the show is, there's a background and that's 10,000 people, and then there's tens of other thousands of people doing the rest of the performance.
I mean, we've always seen this, whenever North Korea is portrayed on television in any way, you always see something from the mass games where all these people are in the stands and they're making pictures of Kim Jong-il or little cartoon animals or something. And it's just amazing how they seem so well trained. Is it something that's difficult, or is it just something that just requires a lot of people doing the same thing at the same time?
They train very hard for it and for a very long time. They train 6 months to a year for a performance like this.
But they're really just turning pages. What's the real skill involved?
I'm doing it in time, and they basically do split second. They have to go from page 60 to page 121, and then back to page 20. It's not in one order or something, so they have to flip back and forth through the book, I think. And
wouldn't it be nice though if it were in one order? That would make things a whole lot simpler.
Yeah, well, if you look at it from a European or Western point of view, you'd probably just put up a big screen and project it on it.
That's true.
Because that's easier and cheaper, but
this is way cooler.
Yeah, it looks really cool, and that's their entire ideology, of course, that people are working together to form one really high-tech thing. And
if you take a close look, you can see little heads sticking out above the books.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yes. It's very funny. But if you have to take a good look, because it's a real big picture, and if you just look in a picture, you don't notice it.
Uh-huh. Now, are these people of all ages?
I think mostly are students.
Uh-huh.
And in the performers, there might be a wider age range, but I think, the backdrops are probably either high school or students, and I think, most of the performers are probably student age, too.
Uh-huh.
One part of the show was mostly children, like 4, 5, 6 years old, and also did pretty,
impressive
high-level gymnastic stuff. It was really amazing.
So each of these kids is like a pixel, in other words.
Well, on the floor they do synchronized stuff, and then in patterns, so they also make out either letters or shapes, or like the shape of the country of Korea.
Uh-huh.
It was.
And someone else has to design this, of course, so that's a whole other job right there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Figuring out how many people are going to form Kim Jong-il's chin or whatever. So, now, you were there. You were in the stadium. You saw this happening. Where were you, actually?
On the other side, on the... just sitting on the tribune, or what do you call it? I don't know the English word for it, but... It was good. It was a 1.5-hour show.
Uh-huh.
And... Yeah, the stadium itself, it was in the May Day Stadium in Pyongyang. It's one of the bigger outdoor stadiums in the world. I think it's supposed to hold 150,000 people standing capacity.
Uh-huh.
Pretty big, and it was pretty, it's impressive, because also in the audience, you're there in a section with mostly all the foreign tourists around there, but most of the audience is Koreans themselves, and you see how they react to certain symbols, symbolic things you see. And even after a couple of days, you recognize all the symbolism towards Kim Jong-il, and especially Kim Il-sung.
Now, there are a lot of people trying to get into these games, trying to get tickets?
I don't know. It was crowded.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. It's being there as a tourist and being there as a regular citizen of Korea that doesn't have all that much contact with each other. So it's all those kind of things are kind of...
I think they perform these mass games for 3 months, 4 nights a week.
Uh-huh.
I think quite a lot of people will get a chance to come see them.
Well, hopefully I'll get a chance someday. I think the next one is 2008.
Yeah, 2008 is probably the next one.
Okay, well, you know.
60th anniversary of the country.
The which anniversary?
The 60th.
2008?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, then maybe they will let me in. That would be nice.
Mm-hmm.
I'd certainly like to see that. I'd like to see a lot of this. Tell us some other sites that you might not know about if you just pay attention to what the media says. As individuals, do you see anything that might surprise us?
Ooh, good one.
We spend a lot of time in Pyongyang, the capital, and it's a big city. It has very wide streets. There's not a lot of traffic. Many people are just walking or riding their bikes. It's a bit like Holland, also many people riding bikes. And they have a lot of green. There's some nice parks and a lot of green in between the roads. There's a lot of mosaics standing on corners depicting scenes of life from Kim Il-sung. And, well, we really like these mosaics, and we took a lot of pictures of them. And one interesting thing is that if you see billboards on the streets, they are not advertisements and commercials from, like, Nike or Puma or whatever, but they are political slogans.
Uh-huh.
Of course, we couldn't read them because they were all in Korean, but it's only the government who's speaking to the people through a medium like billboards. And that was kind of different than you're used to in Europe or the U.S.
Did they use the same way the Chinese government, the same method they use to reach people and have basically newspapers up on the wall?
Mm-hmm.
They do.
Okay, I think on the subway, we were on two subway stations. They show you part of the Pyongyang subway, and they also had, like, the major newspapers behind glass. You can read them. And
the subway stations were a bit like in Moscow and St. Petersburg, very nicely decorated.
Uh-huh.
With really big mosaics. We went to one subway station that depicted Pyongyang as seen from the river. And on one end of the, on one track, you could see a big mosaic that was like the east bank of the city, of the river, and on the other side, you could see the west side of the city.
Uh-huh.
It was pretty impressive.
I imagine it was also very clean.
Yeah,
it's very clean.
Uh-huh. Do you see many people in the streets of Pyongyang?
Yeah, you see a lot of people who are walking there, who are riding their bikes, who are waiting for a bus. And one day it was raining really hard, and we saw, like, hundreds of colorful umbrellas in the streets.
Uh-huh.
And I've heard people say that they think that Pyongyang is very empty, and that there's no people around. But I think we saw quite a lot of people, and the streets are just very wide and big. So maybe that gives the impression that there's not a lot of people around. But I think there were.
I think in general it's very difficult, especially, like, when we live in Amsterdam and you're in the city there, that there's the biggest square in Amsterdam is probably as big and wide as a regular boulevard in Pyongyang. So it looks kind of deserted. And then you look and you start counting the people on one corner. It's like, okay, there's 150 people there, so it's
uh-huh.
not all that quiet. And
what about vehicles? Are there a lot of vehicles on the roads?
I think most of the vehicles you see is either trams. There's trams, trolley buses, and normal buses.
Uh-huh.
Be some trucks. A lot of them are army, I think. And I think most of the cars you see are either government or higher level military.
Okay.
As far as I know, they don't have private ownership of cars.
At all in the country?
Not at all.
Interesting. And something else they don't have, which I imagine is the second time for you on this very same trip, you were in a country that had no McDonald's, right?
Yeah. We didn't miss it.
I mean, that would be surprising if there was McDonald's in Pyongyang.
I think on occasions you can get Coca-Cola, from what I read.
Really?
Sometimes
did you
can,
see any Western...
One place we saw, but that's also probably just for tourists, they had Coke cans.
Did you see any Western branding at all, though? Any kind of advertisement or
yes,
something?
Yes, we saw a lot of Heineken beer, the
really?
Dutch beer that you find everywhere in the world.
Okay.
But it's at the hotels, of course, for the tourists. So.
Yeah.
But nothing in the streets that you can think of.
No, that there's one. Got the name of the company, but there's a car, a new Korean car.
Uh huh.
And it's made by a joint venture between the North Koreans, I think, Fiat, the Italian car company, and Reverend Moon.
From the
in Sun Yun Moon?
Also called the Unification Church.
Right. They actually speak his name in that place?
I don't know.
Wow.
It's something I read when we got back, because it was kind of strange, because they look like normal modern billboards of a car. And it's very strange to see that amidst basically no other billboards. So yeah, that was pretty interesting.
Uh-huh. Now, did you see many other tourists?
Oh, yes. And the funny thing is, after a while, after a week, you get kind of an idea how many tourists or how many Western tourists there are in the city, because you keep running into them at the several monuments and museums.
Uh-huh.
And most Western, there are like two or three hotels that tourists are in. And, well, you get to meet everybody, and you see them at a museum, and then in the evening you see them at a bar in the lobby. And it's funny. You're all together there.
Yeah. Interesting. Now, what was the food like? I imagine you ate most of your meals at the hotels, but did you ever get a chance to go someplace in the middle of the city?
Yeah, we went to a couple of pretty nice restaurants, which were separate restaurants, and even at dinner at a restaurant boat on the Taedong, the main river in Pyongyang. And actually, the food was above my expectations. I mean, it's always kind of difficult with all those stories about famine and things like that. And, of course, you're there as a tourist and as a guest, so they have to, they try and put the best picture. But it was a lot of food, and it was
very good also.
Yeah, it was very good, and it's kind of difficult to not eat all of it, I think.
Uh-huh. But are there, I know you probably weren't allowed to go to them, but are there many restaurants for people who actually live there?
I have no idea. I think the restaurants we were at, some are for quote-unquote regular people.
Uh-huh.
Probably that the regular people are allowed to go to those restaurants, but still. I think there are quite a couple of places like that, though.
Mm-hmm.
But Pyongyang is very, it's a special city within the country, because that's, well, their main place, so. Yeah.
Right.
Now, it was interesting.
How about the media? Did you get to see much TV or radio?
We actually had some Japanese channels and BBC World in our hotel room.
You have BBC World in North Korea, and we can't get it here in the States?
Yeah.
Oh, that's just too much. I don't believe it.
Behind in the U.S.
BBC World in Pyongyang.
Yeah, we were really surprised. We had outside of Korea Central, the national Korean television station. We had NHK, the Japanese TV station. I think one of the CCTVs, the Chinese ones.
Uh-huh. All of them?
No, one.
Okay.
Just one. Don't forget which of the 40 numbers.
I wonder how they pick which one they're going to give you.
Yeah, I think it was like three or four. So one of the.
Well, it's not nine, because that's English.
No, it was not nine. And we had BBC World, which was
the only channel we could understand.
Wow.
We didn't watch much of it, because it's like you're so disconnected there of the outside world, so why watch it?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we were not really interested. But I think that was just for the tourists. We were in another hotel in another city, in Kaesong, and that was just Korea Central. And on the weekends, they have another Korean broadcast station.
So they have a total of two channels in North Korea?
Yeah, as far as we know,
on the weekends they have two, and during the week just one.
Uh-huh. You know, I have to wonder if we might be better off if it was like that here. Imagine that, one channel and then a second one on the weekends, and, you know.
I think at least it will let people do something else and watch TV.
Uh-huh. Did you see any DVDs or VHS tapes or anything like that?
I got a VCD of the 2002 MAS games.
Uh-huh.
And did I buy other? I bought a lot of CDs, but they had VHS tapes of some movies, but I didn't buy them because I don't have a working VHS player anymore.
Uh-huh.
And they didn't have any subtitled movies on VCD, unfortunately, so that's kind of a bummer, but I'll have to find some of those somewhere else. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Korean is an interesting language. We couldn't understand a word of it.
Well, don't you always try to know at least two or three words of a language?
Yes.
I have this theory, my personal language theory, which is that in every country where you go, you should try and learn at least three words in local language, And those are hello, please, and thank you.
Okay.
To be polite, you know. And if you can be polite in somebody's own language, you can do the rest with your hand and feet. But Korean is not very simple, at least not for us. For example, hello is 안녕하십니까. And that is six syllables just to say hello, you know.
Wow. Say that again.
안녕하십니까.
Every time you say that, that's hello.
Yes. If I pronounce it right, it is. I hope I'm pronouncing it right.
Wow.
Sure. And it took me about 4 days to learn that one. And in the end, I told my guys, you know, I would like to say hello, please, and thank you, but I ended up to be able to say hello, thank you, and bathroom.
Well, you know, they're priorities, of course.
Yes, it's very useful. It worked.
Wow. Okay, we're almost out of time, but I just wanted to touch on one more thing before we leave. And you flew into Pyongyang, but then you left North Korea by train. How was that?
That was cool. It was it was actually a bit of a pity that we couldn't go in by train, because then we would have gone all the way from Moscow to Pyongyang by train in one direction. So we did the last part in the other direction, going to the west.
Uh-huh.
But it was really cool. It was like the Chinese train we were on.
Yeah, it was actually Chinese carriages we were on.
Well, the Chinese part, I think, was the nicest part of the whole Trans-Siberian, wasn't it?
Well, I think also the Korean guides we had said it was a pity we weren't on Korean cars.
Uh-huh.
Because the Chinese cars had like the very noisy fan at the ceiling, and the Korean cars, like the Russian cars, have air conditioning.
Oh.
So that was kind of, but what was really nice, and also kind of, yeah, brought back memories of the rest of our trip when we were at Pyongyang railway station. There were two cars going to Beijing and two cars going to Moscow.
Uh-huh.
So they actually had like Pyongyang, Moscow signs on them, and it was kind of like, whoa.
Wouldn't it be cool to take a train once from Moscow to Pyongyang?
Well, supposedly one day you'll be able, once peace breaks out, you'll be able to take a train from Moscow all the way to Seoul.
Woohoo!
Through North Korea.
That would be cool.
We can only dream about that. Well, guys, it's been a lot of fun. Hanukkah and Sasha are my travel companions for most of the summer. They went on to North Korea, and I went on to Japan. I think we both had some interesting times. We have a closing song that Sasha uploaded to us. You want to tell us something about this? It's some kind of reunification song?
The song is called Reunification Rainbow, and it's one of the, I think, more popular songs in North Korea. We've heard it a couple of times there and found it on one of the CDs in the hotel lobby shop and bought it, and it's interesting, let's put it that way.
Reunification Rainbow, is that what it is?
So a reunification rainbow. It's about you reunifying North and South Korea as the one Korea it should be, according to them.
All right, a popular song in North Korea making its North American radio debut. Hanukkah and Sasha, I want to thank you so much for joining us, and hopefully we'll get together again for another interesting voyage.
I hope so.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Have a good night. We'll see you next week on Off the Wall. OTW at 2600.com. Have a good night.
Dylan, press conference, 1965.
Do you think of yourself primarily as a singer or as a poet?
Well, I think of myself more as a song and dance man, you know.
What? Why?
Oh, I don't think we have enough time to really think of that.
We'll see if 12 hours is enough time. On Sunday, October 30th, WUSB Stony Brook will be hosting its third annual Dylan Day, running from the end of Charlie Backfisher's Sunday Street all the way to midnight. A wealth of WUSB programmers will showcase Dylan's work, from the ragamuffin boho who landed in Greenwich Village to the grizzled old-timer who still barnstorms across the country with stops along the way to turn popular songwriting on its head several times over. So join me, Mr. Edison, Charlie Backfish, Roseanne Hoffman, John O., and a host of other programmers for our third annual Dylan Day, right here Sunday, October 30th, exclusively on WUSB 90.1 FM, Stony Brook.
Seems so proud about having to be scrounging.